Order.
Yes, I will. So, as to the reading order, I see this time myself as the first, then Radhika, then Geoffrey, and John Robert, and Andrea in the clockwise direction. And we are on in ch at chapter 11, The Master of the Work, page 246, paragraph 7. Our nature is not only mistaken, etc., etc. Things in that way. Okay. Should we make a couple of minutes of meditation?
John Robert, you want to ring your bell?
Our nature is not only mistaken in will and ignorant in knowledge, but weak in power. But the divine force is there and will lead us if we trust in it, and it will use our deficiencies and our powers for the divine purpose. If we fail in our immediate aim, it is because He has intended the failure. Often our failure or ill result is the right road to a truer issue than an immediate and complete success would have put in our reach. If we suffer, it is because something in us has to be prepared for a rarer possibility of delight. If we stumble, it is to learn in the end the secret of a more perfect walking. Let us not be in too furious a haste to acquire even peace, purity, and perfection. Peace must be ours, but not the peace of an empty or devastated nature, or of slain or mutilated capacities incapable of unrest because we have made them incapable of intensity and fire and force. Purity must be our aim, but not the purity of a void or a bleak and rigid coldness. Perfection is demanded of us, but not the perfection that can exist only by confining its scope within narrow limits or putting an arbitrary full stop to the ever self-extending scroll of the infinite. Our object is to change into the divine nature. But the divine nature is not a mental or moral, but a spiritual condition, difficult to achieve, difficult even to conceive by our intelligence. The master of our work and our yoga knows the thing to be done, and we must allow him to do it in us by his own means and in his own manner.
Is it my turn, Marco?
You think I remember? Well, now I think a different.
It is Radhika's turn from the thing. Yeah. Okay. When you give the order, I always rearrange my photos on the screen so I know which order it is. So
okay, it changed my order.
Well, sometimes I think it may be like when I turn off my camera, or when any of us turns off our camera, then the order switches around, and then we come back on again. Fact, so you, yeah.
Because I remember, in fact, second Radhika, then you, Geoffrey, then Andrea, then John Robert.
Yeah. No, that's not right. I'm after Radhika.
Ah, okay. So John Robert. Oh, but Radhika has now changed again. So I don't find it. Okay. Go ahead. You will do it.
So who's next after Radhika? Okay.
John Robert.
You're muted, Andrea.
Okay, it's Marco, Geoffrey, Jen, Radhika, John Robert, Andrea.
No, that's
not the right order.
No.
Okay, sorry.
Does someone want to put it in the chat so that we'll know?
It's Marco, Radhika, John Robert, me, and then Andrea is what I have now.
Okay, let me just put it in the chat.
Yeah.
So Marco, Radhika,
I write. I always write it. Only this time I didn't write it.
John Robert, and then who? Is it Geoffrey Jen?
Yes. Andrea, and then Andrea.
Okay, Andrea, you're the last. Okay. Okay, so then I will continue with second paragraph, page 247. The movement of the ignorance is egoistic at its core, and nothing is more difficult for us than to get rid of egoism, while yet we admit personality and adhere to action in the half light and half force of our unfinished nature. It is easier to starve the ego by renouncing the impulse to act, or to kill it by cutting away from us all movement of personality. It is easier to exalt it into self-forgetfulness, immersed in a trance of peace or an ecstasy of divine love. But our more difficult problem is to liberate the true person and attain to a divine manhood, which shall be the pure vessel of a divine force and the perfect instrument of a divine action. Step after step has to be firmly taken. Difficulty after difficulty has to be entirely experienced and entirely mastered. Only the divine wisdom and power can do this for us. And it will do all if we yield to it in an entire faith and follow and assent to its workings with a constant courage and patience. Does anybody want to discuss this, or do you just want to go ahead? Because both these paragraphs are very heavy paragraphs.
We already discussed last time. If you still have more things to say, go ahead.
It's just that always these paragraphs... I remember I even asked you about the Enneagrams, right? Yeah, okay, yeah. Let's go ahead.
Okay. The first step on this long path is to consecrate...
It's my turn. It's my turn, Geoffrey Jen.
Sorry.
The first step on this long path is to consecrate all our works as a sacrifice to the divine in us and in the world. This is an attitude of the mind and heart, not too difficult to initiate, but very difficult to make absolutely sincere and all-pervasive. Second step is to renounce attachment to the fruit of our works. For the only true, inevitable, and utterly desirable fruit of sacrifice, the one thing needful, is the divine presence and the divine consciousness and power in us. And if that is gained, all else will be added. This is a transformation of the egoistic will in our vital being, our desire soul and desire nature, and it is far more difficult than the other. The third step is to get rid of the central egoism and even the ego sense of the worker. That is the most difficult transformation of all, and it cannot be perfectly done if the first two steps have not been taken. But these first steps too cannot be completed unless the third comes in to crown the movement, and by the extinction of egoism, eradicates the very origin of desire. Only when the small ego sense is rooted out from the nature can the seeker know his true person that stands above as a portion and power of the divine and renounce all motive force other than the will of the divine Shakti.
Do I keep going or shall we stop?
I'm going, maybe? Fine to go on. Radhika, anybody else want to?
I was just going to say, if any of you has something to say, I will listen. I don't have anything to say, but if someone has something to say, I can listen.
Okay. There are gradations in this last integralizing movement, for it cannot be done at once or without long approaches that bring it progressively nearer and make it at last possible. The first attitude to be taken is to cease to regard ourselves as the worker and firmly to realize that we are only one instrument of the cosmic force. At first, it is not the one force, but many cosmic forces that seem to move us, but these may be turned into feeders of the ego. And this vision liberates the mind, but not the rest of the nature. Even when we become aware of all as the working of one cosmic force and of the divine behind it, that too need not liberate. If the egoism of the worker disappears, the egoism of the instrument may replace it or else prolong it in a disguise. The life of the world has been full of instances of egoism of this kind, and it can be more engrossing and enormous than any other. There is the same danger in yoga. A man becomes a leader of men or eminent in a large or lesser circle and fills himself full of a power that he knows to be beyond his own ego force. He may be aware of a fate acting through him or a will mysterious and unfathomable, or a light within of great brilliance. There are extraordinary results of his thoughts, his actions, or his creative genius. He effects some tremendous destruction that clears the path for humanity, or some great construction that becomes its momentary resting place. He is a scourge, or he is a bringer of light and healing, a creator of beauty, or a messenger of knowledge. Or, if his work and its effects are on a lesser scale and have a limited field, still they are attended by the strong sense that he is an instrument and chosen for his mission or his labor. Men who have this destiny and these powers come easily to believe and declare themselves to be mere instruments in the hand of God or of fate. But even in the declaration, we can see that there can intrude or take refuge an intenser and more exaggerated egoism than ordinary men have the courage to assert or the strength to house within them. And often, if men of this kind speak of God, it is to erect an image of him, which is really nothing but a huge shadow of themselves or their own nature, a sustaining deific essence of their own type of will and thought and quality and force. This magnified image of their ego is the master whom they serve. This happens only too often in yoga, to strong and crude vital natures or minds too easily exalted when they allow ambition, pride, or the desire of greatness to enter into their spiritual seeking and vitiate its purity of motive. A magnified ego stands between them and their true being and grasps for its own personal purpose the strength from a greater unseen power, divine or undivine, acting through them, of which they become vaguely and intensely aware. An intellectual perception or vital sense of a force greater than ours and of ourselves, as moved by it, is not sufficient to liberate from the ego.
Andrea, it's your turn, I think. Andrea.
Okay, John Robert, you read already? I'm so confused.
Yes, okay. Yes, I read already. It's your turn.
This perception, this sense of a greater power in us or above and moving us, is not a hallucination or a megalomania. Those who thus feel and see have a larger sight than ordinary men and have advanced a step beyond the limited physical intelligence, but theirs is not the plenary vision or the direct experience. Or because they are not clear in mind and aware in soul, because their awakening is more in the vital parts than into the spiritual substance of self, with a capital S, they cannot be the conscious instruments of the divine or come face to face with the master, but are used through their fallible and imperfect nature. The most they see of the divinity is a fate or cosmic force, or else they give his name to a limited godhead, or worse, to a titanic or demoniac power that veils them. Even certain religious founders have erected the image of the god of a sect or a national god, or a power of terror and punishment, or a noumen of subtle love and mercy and virtue, and seem not to have seen the one and eternal. The divine accepts the image they make of him and does his work in them through that medium. But since the one force is felt and acts in their imperfect nature, but more intensely than in others, the motive principle of egoism too can be more intense in them than in others. An exalted rajasic or sattvic ego still holds them and stands between them and the integral truth. Even this is something, a beginning, although far from the true and perfect experience. A much worse thing may befall those who break something of the human bonds, but have not purity and have not the knowledge, for they may become instruments, but not of the divine. Too often, using his name, they serve unconsciously his masks and black contraries, the powers of darkness.
Shall we discuss this? I mean, what is the meaning of the last sentence?
So we see in the world figures that become spiritual leaders to a larger or a smaller group of people. And because they are not all the way there, they can serve powers of darkness.
But are they spiritual? Like, do you consider how if they are spiritual, how do they become? I don't understand. Like, if you are a spiritual leader.
It seems there are many gradations of being spiritual.
I mean, is he talking about people like, you know, like ISIS and Taliban? Because they are not spiritual. But they are not spiritual. They are just terrorists. Like, what is he talking about?
Well, he's talking about the ego, right? So he's talking about those. Remember, the ego is this sense of being attached to things. So if you're attached to, you know, so those three steps, the consecration, the detachment of the instrument and the detachment of the doer. The middle one was the detachment of the fruit. So, you know, if you think you're doing good work and you're tied up with the product of what you've done, then you are attached to the fruit and you're not clear about, you know, the fact that it's the divine working through you anyway. So why are you so attached to the fruit, right? And then if it's the third one, it's the doer. If you're so proud of everything that you've done, then you're not detached from yourself as the doer, and you're not recognizing that your doing is, you know. So you have these spiritual leaders who believe that they are acting for God and often take on that kind of discourse, right? I am the voice of God.
Yeah, I'm the voice.
But yeah, whenever somebody says I am the voice of God, I start to get nervous. Because that already is a kind of proclamation that is unlikely to be the case if you were really the voice of God. So it's that attachment is stuff which gets. So that's, I think that's the sense of what it says. Of course.
No, I was thinking more about like, is there a, what kind of examples come to mind? Like, who is it that became spiritual, but then also became egoistic? Like an example of somebody who did that. And I guess it must be religious leaders, right? Typically religious leaders.
Well, I think of some of the, I only know because I'm picking cases from what I've read in the news, but, you know, cases of spiritual people who have spiritual practices or whatever, who have then been involved in, you know, sexual.
Osho. Osho
was an example. What if, you know, attack or whatever of somebody else? Well, that's an example where the person thinks that they are in some sense detached, but they're clearly not, because they carry out these kinds of acts. So,
but they've still taken that first step, right? So they've taken the first step and become somewhat detached, but then they failed in like the subsequent steps. So it was a partial but not complete detachment from the ego. But there is a partial detachment, right? So they took the first step, but then stumbled.
Yeah, but it's hard to call somebody a saint if they've raped, for instance. It doesn't cut it for me.
So, Radhika, can you put your whole face in the screen? Yeah, that's better. You were just coming down.
Yeah, I'm sitting on my bed, and so it's like I'm bouncing around.
But what came to my mind a bit thinking about this last sentence, rereading it now, is also the story that Mother tells in the agenda, huh, about Hitler, who was, in fact, how can we say, the puppet of dark forces. And I think this is a good example where everyone, I hope, can agree that he was certainly not spiritual in the positive sense. But when we speak about spiritual, it's difficult also the word, what does it mean really to be spiritual? Spiritual in the sense that we ascend higher states of consciousness, then it means that we detach from our ego. If we mean spiritual in the sense of occultism, that's a bit different thing, yeah? Even though people may misinterpret the occult forces as spiritual forces, but they are not. In fact, Mother said that Hitler was a medium and he was in contact with this Lord of the Nations, this Azul, this demoniac being, and he was, in a certain sense, serving him. And that's where I see here, Sri Aurobindo says that there is a risk that if you detach from something of the human bonds, which you go beyond the normal human ordinary consciousness, you can not necessarily become servant of a divine force, but become instrument of powers of darkness. There is this risk if you do not detach from your ego. That's how I interpret this last sentence.
And I believe that what happened go back to Hitler for a moment, because he was an instrument, he got inspired. And because he got inspired, he could inspire masses of other people. When he spoke, he would transcend himself. And people would feel it and would be swept up in it. And so they could feel that there was a power greater than him that came through. And that's why he was so seductive to so many people, because they couldn't see what the force was behind him.
But it was mostly uneducated workers who were attracted to him, right?
No, it was not. No.
Oh, no. Doctors and lawyers and everybody, all the way up and down society. The educated to the non-educated, everybody. Not everybody, but masses of everybody. He had a way to address the national ego. So he had a way to aggrandize the national ego. And because people were not aware of those things, of like a national ego, how dangerous that is, they thought this great. You know, it's happening today. You know, we are the greatest. And
So I was just going to say, you just brought up the subject of national ego, right? And I was reading... So this human unity, ideal of human unity, and something Aurobindo has written that also. And in it, he refers to the World War. And he says that although Germany lost the Second World War, it won the after war. And I like, so he says that. So Nietzsche indirectly inspired the generation that fell for Hitler. And he said that Nietzsche's ideas are taking over, and like he talks about how Europe is becoming this extremely socialist and centralized. Today we have the European Union, right? But he foresees it in, I think the book is called Ideal of Human Unity. I was reading it last year. But he clearly says this, that even though a nation may lose a war, its ideals may win the after war. Which I still kind of haven't processed that, but he said this about Hitler, but I always thought that Hitler came to power because the working classes voted him in. I didn't realize that middle class people were involved.
He was democratically elected. They had a democracy with a democratic voting system, and he was democratically elected, just like Trump.
Yeah, there were
also, it doesn't go away.
A lot of professors and academics and highly intelligent people who stood behind him. And I bet that nowadays, if something similar would represent them, they would not do something very different. And this is a typical example that the mind alone and intellectual skills are not enough if you're not in contact with some inner divine force. The intellect is something that can be used for the good or for the destruction. And these intellectuals, academic intellectuals, were the perfect example of that. There were also exceptions, of course. Einstein, for example, Planck, but not many, I think. And they were also famous. Heidegger? Heidegger's a famous... But even after the war, he did not admit that he made some error or judgment. He continued to be a convinced Nazi. Yeah? Heidegger, the la crème de la crème of the intellect of those times. So mind is a force but can be the force of the darkness or of the horse light. That's what he is trying to tell us here. No? It depends on which side the ego goes.
Yeah, or more dangerously, a mix of those.
Yeah.
So there can be many.
Let us be clear, it's a force of evil. The association with darkness is weird. I mean, it's universally acknowledged, but I have been writing a poem called The Rehabilitation of Darkness, which is attempting to address this issue. Because, of course, the problem with associating dark with evil is it supports racism. I mean, the whole... demonization of people of color comes from the fact that we associate evil with dark and black. So if we're going to overcome racism, we need to address this issue of darkness being necessarily evil. It isn't necessarily evil. So, well, that's my bugaboo, but anyway.
One more thing about Germany. Sri Aurobindo also said, he said that Germany was searching for its soul. And in the years before World War I and World War II, Germany was searching for its soul, the nation soul. And he said that every nation needed to undertake that. The thing that Germany undertook, but not make the same mistake that Germany made, but still undertake that. And he said the mistake that Germany made was that they mistook the vital ego for the soul.
Yeah, I remember this, John Robert, exactly what you're saying, that they mistook something lower for something higher. I think it was called Ideal of Human Unity. This is where he was talking about the German example, how Germany rose. Because I think in World War I, they were defeated and they were in a very poor state and they got back up.
There was a very hostile or revengeful treaty that they were forced into after World War I, that the German people were forced into.
Yeah.
Revengeful. And so they were, you know, they were, even after the so-called peace, they were under all kinds of restrictions.
Right. They had been humiliated.
Yeah.
And there is also another Sri Aurobindo in the Ideal of Human Unity, I think, or in War and Self-Determination, I don't remember where, he says that also the opposite is true. That there was a light coming up in the nation, that philosophers, scientists, also intellectuals, and whoever were discovering something that was going beyond the intellect, but then it was perverted. Something spiritual, something divine has been perverted in something evil. But there was a light coming up, and then it has been catched. For example, the idea of Nietzsche, of the superman, no? There is the core of this idea that we can transcend ourselves into a new evolutionary stage. But then it has been catched by the dark side of the force, so to speak, and has been perverted into some form of, yes, not some form, in a real racist and violent, azuric, demonic ideology. So I think I'm as the next. If I'm not wrong. So our nature must house the cosmic force, but not in its lower aspect or in its rajasic or sattvic movement. It must serve the universal will. but in the light of a greater liberating knowledge. There must be no egoism of any kind in the attitude of the instrument, even when we are fully conscious of the greatness of the force within us. Every man is knowingly or unknowingly the instrument of a universal power. And apart from the inner presence, there is no such essential difference between one action and another, one kind of instrumentation and another, as would warrant the folly of an egoistic pride. The difference between knowledge and ignorance is a grace of the spirit. The breath of divine power blows where it lists and fills today one and tomorrow another with the word of puissance. I read this again. The difference between knowledge and ignorance is a grace of the spirit. The breath of divine power blows where it lists and fills today one and tomorrow another with the word or the puissance. If the potter shapes one pot more perfectly than another, the merit lies not in the best vessel, but the maker. The attitude of our mind must not be, this is my strength, or behold God's power in me, but rather a divine power works in this mind and body, and it is the same that works in all man and in the animal, in the plant and in the metal, in conscious and living things, and in things apparently inconscient and inanimate. This large view of the one working in all and of the whole world as the equal instrument of a divine action and gradual self-expression, if it becomes our entire experience, will help to eliminate all rajasic egoism out of us, and even the sattvic ego sense will begin to pass away from our nature.
The elimination of this form of ego leads straight towards the true instrumental action, which is the essence of a perfect karma yoga. For while we cherish the instrumental ego, we may pretend to ourselves that we are conscious instruments of the divine. But in reality, we are trying to make of the divine shakti an instrument of our own desires or our egoistic purpose. And even if the ego is subjected but not eliminated, we may indeed be engines of the divine work, but we shall be imperfect tools and deflect or impair the workings by our mental errors, our vital distortions, or the obstinate incapacities of our physical nature. If this ego disappears, then we can truly become not only pure instruments consciously consenting to every turn of the divine hand that moves us, but aware of our true nature, conscious portions of the one eternal infinite, put out in herself for her works by the supreme shakti. Shall I read the last sentence again? If this ego disappears, then we can truly become not only pure instruments consciously consenting to every turn of the divine hand that moves us, but aware of our true nature, conscious portions of the one eternal and infinite put out in herself for her works by the supreme shakti.
Any discussion here?
Actually, I did not get the, like, literally the English. So, like, that last sentence where he says, okay, so we consent to the divine hand moving us and become aware of our true nature. And what does that mean? Conscious portions of the one eternal and infinite put out in herself. So the eternal, is that a masculine thing? I always associate eternal with masculine. So eternal is put out in herself.
For her works by the supreme shakti. The herself is the shakti.
I thought the order was different. Isn't it the eternal who is masculine who puts out the shakti rather than shakti?
They're one. The two are one. The Shakti and the divine are one.
Okay.
The eternal is not greater than the Shakti. They are one.
Like in Hinduism, they always consider the eternal the greatest. Usually, most, like Shaivite, I mean, like, you know, like in the south of India, most people are Shaivites and the eternal is Shiva. And Shiva is usually considered greater than Shakti.
Well,
the two are one. So he's saying they are one, but Shakti puts out the eternal. Yeah, that's very good. Okay, I'm just playing with words. I don't understand what that means.
Well, I also had to relook at that, Radhika, when you read it, because you would expect, expect the English, conscious portions of the one eternal and infinite put out in himself for her works by the Supreme Shakti. But it's actually, I mean, if you look at it, it's what is put out. The Shakti is the one that's doing the works, and the works of Shakti are creation. So that includes herself.
And all the instruments.
We are
all parts of her.
Mm-hmm.
This is really funny that I'm reading this, because like just this morning I had not an argument, I was discussing like the roles of women and men in leadership with someone. And this guy was saying that, you know, leadership, like people, so traditionally a leadership is perceived as being a masculine endeavor, and that feminine qualities are punished in a public leader. So like if a public leader displays empathy, they have to pay a penalty for that. So he was saying that. And he was sad about it because he feels that leaders should be more openly feminine. And we were talking about that. And then like just a few hours later, I'm reading this. So it's very, and one of my professors, like she was talking about this whole gender issue. And she says that there is no such thing as gender. Therefore, there is no such thing as an essential feminine quality at all. Like she was saying that there is no such thing as the feminine. So like the default is the masculine. So the way she puts it, the feminine is something that is taught to you by society and doesn't exist in reality. And I was like, is that true? Can that actually? So I was thinking about that a lot. And that's why I was talking to this guy. Whether there is a womanly way of being a leader versus a manly way of being a leader. And people are not very clear about this.
So if there is no feminine, then there is no masculine. Then there's only one.
No.
It has to go together. It cannot be the masculine is the leader and the feminine doesn't exist.
No. Like my professor was saying that there is no such division, that there is only the masculine. And the feminine is basically something that is unreal and created by society. So which is that? Can that be true, that there is only...
I think what's happening...
Because Aurobindo talks about transcending dualities, right? So like, is the male-female duality... I mean, is it a duality or is it something like how do you, because he speaks clearly of the eternal being projected by the Shakti. So I don't know what that means, but clearly there is a duality there. And yeah, I don't know, because this is a very important topic. So I'm doing a PhD in education, right? And we're always talking about gender issues in education. And like some of the professors are, oh my God, they're so passionate about this. Like this woman professor I was talking about, she's very good-hearted. I mean, she really wants for more women to be like scientists and engineers. And so from that point of view, she's really passionate. And she says that there is no such thing as the feminine. She just denies that. So I don't know what to think. I'm very confused.
I think the relationship between the one and the duality is paradoxical in its nature. That is to say, you know, you both exist, the one and the duality, which is a contradiction, but that's what paradox is about.
You have the one, how can you have the duality?
Well, yes, but that's the way the universe works. It works by contradiction and paradox. It's not all sit within a logical system. Logics exclude those kinds of things, but the universe does not, you know, so.
But do you think, you're a scientist, right? Do you think that women scientists are fundamentally different from male scientists? Have you noticed any difference?
Well, I'm not a good person to talk to because I'm gender fluid, so I'm...
Oh, gender fluid, okay. I'm not against gender fluidity, don't get me wrong. Like, I'm happy. I really want to know about this issue. Like, so we have Ardhana Arishwari in Hinduism, right? Who is half male, half female. But I just want to know, I mean, why is this there, this gender duality? And people get really passionate about it. And so why do we even have sexual dimorphism? There are many species without sexual dimorphism. Why do we have it? And why is it that women are always the ones who have things done to them? I mean, is that God's will or...
No. I think it comes back to the darkness issue, because the feminine is put into the same camp of darkness with all the other stuff. So if we stop thinking in those terms, we might actually get somewhere.
But can we not see this as a Chinese yin-yang? You know, Radhika, the...
Oh, yeah, yin-yang.
So the yin-yang, it is a duality, and yet it is one. But it has a yin and yang, but it is one. And so, and there is, and if the yin goes out of balance with respect to the yang, then there is disharmony. If there is balance between the two, there is a harmony that expresses itself as a unity, but in diversity, yin-yang, because they are diverse, but form a unity. And I think we can see male, female in a similar way. And by the way, I think also what is also important, especially in the spiritual things in yoga, not only in this yoga, in every spiritual path, I don't think that we should identify male, female with or only with a bodily appearance. Because a man, physically a man, may have very female components, psychological components, emotional components, mental components, and a woman may have very male components, so to speak. And I would even say, what does it mean, male, female, beyond the sexual, physical distinction? I think if we go deeper into these writings, we see that these are words, but they do not express a biological distinction. They express more the yin-yang from a spiritual point of view as polarity that forms a unity and two things that complement each other. And the problem that we have today, that we have a disbalance. These things are not balanced. And that's where all this turmoil comes from, and all these discussions and emotions.
So I agree, but I mean, you're also a scientist, right? In Germany, right? So in your practical experience, like I'm not talking about like the spiritual reality, but in your everyday reality, do you think women scientists are different from male scientists? Is there a fundamental difference in behavior or in attitude or in their achievements? There is.
There is, but the question is, if this difference is a natural difference, or is it something that is imposed by society, by your education, and so I think more or less in all the world, girls have to play with
dolls.
Dolls, And the boys have to play with toys and trucks and machines. Already there, something of our society instills in our minds something, and then it develops also as grown-ups. So the question is, I see the difference, yes, but it's difficult to separate this from a social effect or from something that is truly comes from a psychic a component. I don't think that there is a real difference, but I think it has been imposed by our society.
But society is also something that it comes from the divine, right? Society is not something that is fundamentally separate from the divine. Just as there is an individual soul, there is also a collective or nation soul, like John Robert was talking about, right? So that is also an expression of the divine. So, I mean, there is no, also my, I was just thinking that God did not intend that women should be a certain way and men should be a certain way in their practical activities. I'm not talking about the Shakti and the Shiva. So it's not God's will that women should only play with dolls and men should only...
Happily, because I played with dolls when I was a boy, so...
Okay, no, because like it's so passionately argued. You know, I know some professors here in the US who really think that women should be a certain way and that men are the ones that are gifted and brilliant and that women do not have the capacity for brilliance. So like
there's the brilliant male ego at work.
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay, let's get back to the book.
I think it's my turn. Did you read the last paragraph, Radhika?
Yeah, I think I finished, yeah.
Okay. There's another greater step to be taken after the surrender of our instrumental ego to the divine Shakti. It is not enough to know her as the one cosmic force that moves us and all creatures on the planes of mind, life, and matter. For this is the lower nature. And all of the divine knowledge, light, power are there concealed and at work in this ignorance and can break partly its veil and manifest something of their true character or descend from above and uplift these inferior workings. Yet, even if we realize the one in a spiritualized mind, a spiritualized life movement, a spiritualized body consciousness, an imperfection remains in the dynamic parts. There's a stumbling response to the supreme power, a veil over the face of the divine, a constant mixture of the ignorance. It is only when we open to the divine Shakti and the truth of her force, which transcends this lower prakriti, that we can be perfect instruments of her power and knowledge.
Not only liberation, but perfection must be the aim of the Karma Yoga. The divine works through our nature and according to our nature. If our nature is imperfect, the work also will be imperfect, mixed, inadequate. Even it may be marred by gross errors, falsehoods, moral weaknesses, diverting influences. The work of the divine will be done in us even then, but according to our weakness, not according to the strength and purity of its sources. If ours were not an integral yoga, if we sought only the liberation of the self within us, or the motionless existence of Purusha separated from Prakriti, this dynamic imperfection might not matter. Calm, untroubled, not depressed, not elated, refusing to accept the perfection or imperfection, fault or merit, sin or virtue as ours, perceiving that it is the nodes of nature working in the field of her modes that make this mixture, We could withdraw into the silence of the spirit and pure, untouched, witness only the workings of Prakriti. But in an integral realization, this can only be a step on the way, not our last resting place. For we aim at the divine realization not only in the immobility of the spirit, but also in the movement of nature. And this cannot be altogether until we can feel the presence and power of the divine in every step, motion, figure of our activities, in every turn of our will, in every thought, feeling, and impulse. No doubt we can feel that in essence, even in the nature of the ignorance, but it is the divine power and presence in a disguise, a diminution, an inferior figure. Ours is a greater demand, that our nature shall be a power of the divine in the truth of the divine, in the light, in the force of the eternal self-conscient will, in the wideness of the sempiternal knowledge.
After the removal of the veil of ego, the removal of the veil of nature and her inferior modes that govern our mind, life, and body. There's no verb in there. After the removal of the veil of ego, the removal of the veil of nature and her inferior modes that govern our mind, life, and body. Sounds like a half a sentence. As soon as the limits of the ego begin to fade, we see how that veil is constituted and detect the action of cosmic nature in us. And in or behind cosmic nature, we sense the presence of the cosmic self and the nine dynamisms of the world pervading Ishvara. The master of the instrument stands behind all this working. And even within the working, there is his touch and the drive of a great guiding or disposing influence. It is no longer ego or ego force that we serve. We obey the world master and his evolutionary impulse. At each step, we say in the language of the Sanskrit verse, even as I am appointed by thee, seated in my heart, so, O Lord, I act. But still this action may be of two very different kinds, one only illumined, the other transformed and uplifted into a greater supernature. For we may keep on in the way of action upheld and followed by our nature, when by her and her illusion of egoism, we were turned as if mounted on a machine. But now with a perfect understanding of the mechanism and its utilization for his world purposes by the master of works whom we feel behind it. I think I need to read this line again. But still this action may be of two very different kinds. One only illumined, the other transformed and uplifted into a greater supernature. For we may keep on in the way of action upheld and followed by our nature, when by her and her illusion of egoism, we were turned as if mounted on a machine. But now with a perfect understanding of the mechanism and its utilization for his world purposes by the master of works, whom we feel behind it. This is indeed as far as even many great yogis have reached on the levels of spiritualized mind. But it need not be so always, for there is a greater supramental possibility. It is possible to rise beyond spiritualized mind and to act spontaneously in the living presence of the original divine truth force of the Supreme Mother. Our motion, one with her motion, and merged in it. Our will, one with her will, our energy absolved in her energy. We shall feel her working through us as a divine manifest in a supreme wisdom power, and we shall be aware of the transformed mind, life, and body only as the channels of a supreme light and force beyond them, infallible in its steps because transcendent and total in its knowledge. Of this light and force, we shall not only be the recipients, channels, instruments, but become a part of it in a supreme, uplifted, abiding experience.
Already before we reach this last perfection, we can have the union with the divine in works in its extreme wideness, if not yet on its most luminous heights, for we perceive no longer merely nature or the modes of nature, but become conscious in our physical movements, in our nervous and vital reactions, in our mental workings, of a force greater than body, mind, and life, which takes hold of our limited instruments and drives all their motion. There is no longer the sense of ourselves moving, thinking, or feeling, but of that moving, feeling, and thinking in us. This force that we feel is the universal force of the divine, which, veiled or unveiled, acting directly or permitting the use of its powers by beings in the cosmos, is the one energy that alone exists and alone makes universal or individual action possible. For this force is the divine itself in the body of its power. All is that power of act, power of thought and knowledge, power of mastery and enjoyment, power of love. Conscious always and in everything, in ourselves and in others, of the master of works possessing, inhabiting, enjoying through this force that is himself, becoming through it all existence and all happenings, we shall have arrived at the divine union through works and achieved by that fulfillment in works all that others have gained through absolute devotion or through pure knowledge. But there is still another step that calls us, an ascent out of this cosmic identity into the identity of the divine transcendence. I read the last part. The master of our works and our being is not merely a Godhead here within us, nor is he merely a cosmic spirit or some kind of universal power. The world and the divine are not one and the same thing, as a certain kind of pantheistic thinking would like to believe. The world is an emanation. It depends upon something that manifests in it, but is not limited by it. The divine is not here alone. There is beyond an eternal transcendence. The individual being, also in its spiritual part, is not a formation in the cosmic existence. Our ego, our mind, our life, our body are that. But the immutable spirit, the imperishable soul in us has come out of the transcendence.
We have to discuss this, Marco. Because there are some words here. He says things like the world and the divine are not one, but the world is an emanation. And then he says that something about manifestation, and then he talks about transcendence, and then he talks about cosmic existence. It's a lot of words, a lot of like big words, like Trump would say, I guess, big words. So like, what does he mean by that, really? The world and the divine are not one and the same thing, as a certain kind of pantheistic thinking would like to believe. So there are two questions I have. So, I mean, like in Hinduism, we do say that the divine is in the heart of everything, animate or inanimate, is that what he means by pantheistic thinking, believes that world and the divine are one? So in what sense is the world separate from the divine? And what does he mean by saying the world is an emanation? What does it mean, emanation?
Projection, some comes out of the world. But pantheism means that there is this philosophical
lower forms of Hinduism, like village folk Hinduism, is pantheistic because they believe in, it's like the Greek pagan world, they believe in lots of gods.
Yeah, okay, but here in this context the word pantheism means something a little different. It means that pan comes from the Greek, means everything.
Mm.
Theism comes from theos, means God or divinity. And everything is God. And there is this, I think he's implying more than Western theism. Okay, implying more the Western philosophy than the Indian. Okay. For example, Spinoza was a pantheist in the sense that he identified nature with God itself. Nature and God are the same thing. And there is another version, which is panentheism, which means that everything is in God, but not everything is only God. God and nature separated, or this is pantheism and this is panentheism. And Sri Aurobindo says this, there's even a higher level where these two are the emanations of something that is even higher, transcendent. So the divine, Prakriti and Purusha. Prakriti is nature, Purusha, the world soul, so to speak. But both come from the transcendence, that which is beyond everything, time, space.
What does he mean by saying the last sentence? Can you read that again?
The individual being, also in its spiritual part, is not a formation in the cosmic existence. Our ego, our mind, our life, our body are that. But the immutable spirit, the imperishable soul in us, has come out of the transcendence. You can imagine this with a graph, something up there, and there comes out something that is emanated, like a ray of the sun. A ray of the sun is something that is emanated by the sun, but the ray is not the sun, it's something that comes out, or is part, if you wish, of the sun. But the sun can exist also without a ray that comes out, but can travel.
Yeah, but the ray cannot exist without the sun, but the sun can exist without the ray.
This is my analogy. It doesn't work really good. But the transcendence exists also without the manifestation, without the universe, stars, planets, us, our bodies. And we can also, in a certain sense, say we are, our soul is the emanation of a super soul, if you will. Emanation in this thing.
He's saying that the spiritual part has come out of the transcendence.
Yeah.
But he says imperishable
soul.
Imperishable spirit.
What I'm hearing, I find is very interesting, this sentence, the individual being also in its spiritual part is not a formation in the cosmic existence. That means my spiritual being, my true being, the individual true being in myself is not part of the material world. It is a descent into my body. It is a descent from the transcendent. That is how a part of us is a part of the transcendent in the material world. We are more than just a material existence. I don't know if that helps, but that's kind of what got clear for me.
Certainly the way I read it, but I don't necessarily agree with it. So,
Would you disagree with this, Jeffrey Jen? What is there to disagree in this?
Because I tend to be very skeptical of the transcendent. I'm much more comfortable with the imminent.
How do you conceive the difference?
The transcendent as some sort of external whatever, and the imminent is about the what's in the body, in the world.
But if it is imminent, doesn't come in from...
Doesn't have to. It can just be there.
What is imminent? That would not be... That would be beyond the material existence. You don't see that.
I don't necessarily believe that anything is beyond the material existence. So,
We can easily get lost in mental terminology here because that's what we use.
Yeah.
That's what we know. That's what we know by. And
go ahead, John Rob. Sorry.
So Sri Aurobindo is using language that we can relate to. He's using English. English is a language of the cosmos. And it's not completely adequate to what Sri Aurobindo is talking about. In fact, if you read the mother's work, especially in the later part of her life, she's constantly saying that language, no, I can say it this way, but it's not really what happened. So that's a basic, the image that I like is the map is not the territory. So Sri Aurobindo is giving us a map, and we, in English, we can understand a map, but actually he's trying to point to something else. And this has been the case in all the things we've discussed today, you know, the duality versus unity. The mind doesn't do very well with those things. The mind does really well with distinctions, with differences. But the spirit, in the unity of the spirit is very hard to express in English. So Sri Aurobindo uses the language of Indian spiritual philosophy, and he uses lots of metaphors in savitri to transmit something that can't be contained in the denotation of the words. So he's sending us something in all of these words. He's sending us something that really goes beyond the denotation of the words. And it's like it's up to us to try to catch it and not to press too far the denotations, because that's the denotation that's only part of the thing. So he's talking about the difference between the world and the transcendent. And he says in the Life Divine, he says the transcendent, the supreme, has absolute power. And one of those powers is the power to self-limit. And he projects himself in a self-limitation as the cosmos. And that self-limited cosmos is the divine because it's projection of him, but it's not the total divine because it's a self-limited projection. The total divine is there, but it's not, the cosmos is not everything.
I like what you just said, but once it's self-limited, it's gone. So like if I cut off my arm is not me anymore.
But the part of you that's speaking is not the divine. That's not the divine word that you're speaking. I mean, if you cut off your arm, the arm that's cut off is part of the divine, just as the rest of your body is. But the limited person that says, I am my body, that's not the full voice of the divine. That's a voice of of the partial consciousness, which we all share. We all know what that partial consciousness is. But that's not what we're called to. That's what we experience. That's what we think is real. That's what we act as real. That's not the fullness of what we're called to.
This is what you say. So I really like what you're saying, Don Robert, because I have this sense when I read Aurobindo deeply. So I'm not comfortable with terms like transcendence, but I have this sense when I read Aurobindo that he doesn't disagree with me. Even though I know my opinion about this is different from what most people seem to think. But I find when I read Aurobindo, I find more affinity with the way I think about the world than difference about these things. So it's my sense that there is some way in which the sort of my understanding of the immanent is close to Aurobindo's understanding of the divine. And, you know, so, you know, he uses terms like transcendent, but I don't think I have to agree with all of those things to get the sense of what Aurobindo is saying, you know? So anyway, I could be wrong, but my sense of the world being immanent more than it is transcendent is a very deep conviction that I have. It goes right down to the bottom of my soul, if you like. Well, and it's not an easy thing for me to challenge or disagree with, or, you know, I'm always questioning everything. But there are some things that are very difficult to bring into challenge that way. And I see no reason to challenge it, because when I look at Aurobindo, as I say, I don't find a fundamental difference in the way he talks about these things ultimately, even though he uses a different language than I would use.
You get to approach it in your own way, GJ. All of us do. You get to approach it. It's fine to approach it the way you're approaching it. It's fine for all of us. That's why we have diversity. That's why we have the many instead of just the one, because we get to explore all these different ways. And in this, you know, this group of five, we get to explore all these different ways. And we're reading this master and what he's transmitting to us will come out in different ways in each of us. And yet somehow the one and the many are one. Sri Aurobindo does say that the many is real, but he says the one, the reality of the one has precedence over the reality of the many, but they're both real.
I really like what you said about the map and the territory, John Robert. And I wanted to say, you know, like, obviously I'm a graduate student, so I'm approaching this text like I would, like a textbook, like literally like a PhD student attacking a textbook. Mm-hmm. So I come from that mentality, and I'm sorry if because I get the sense that you're saying that he's trying to express something that cannot really be expressed in words. And I'm focusing on the words.
Yeah, exactly. This is the problem that we focus unavoidably. As long as we live on this mental ordinary state of consciousness, it's unavoidable. But we must be aware of the fact that words imply distinctions and are based on a mental analytical understanding of reality that sees contraries, sees contradictions, and has a difficulty to put together these contradictions. For example, here we have this issue, transcendence, immanence. But perhaps there is an immanent transcendent. Is this a play of words? I don't know. You have to feel it. I think it's possible, but it's not something that I can explain you with a formula. That there can be an immanent transcendence, and that we see contraries and contradictions where there more, when we go more deeply, there are none. They're complementaries, but not contradictions. So yes, we have to see more comprehensively, perhaps. That's the problem. Expand our mind and see comprehensively. And that's where we stumble, probably, also by reading this text.
Radhika, I want to say that I got my first real understanding of mentality and its limitations in graduate school. I was taking a class in cognitive anthropology, and the professor was explaining how concepts work. And he says, concepts work by definitions. And of course, a definition means it has fines, which is a Latin word which means ends or boundaries. So we understand something by putting boundaries around it, by defining it. Okay, this is rain, this is not sleet, and it's not earth, and it's not mist, it's rain. Well, how is that? Because it's not this, and it's not this, and it's not this. So then we put boundaries. That's the way the mind works. And despite that, I think all of us here, I'm sure all of us here, have had experiences of things that we can't express in words, or things that have been expressed in words, and yet we hear something more. We hear something more in it. It's like it echoes in some part of us, it resonates in some part of us. And that's what Sri Aurobindo is doing in all of his writings. He's speaking to us in mental language, but he's a master of it. And so he's able to send us words that will resonate beyond the meaning of the words. And I think, but in graduate school, well, for me, you know, I had 10 years in seminary. I never learned that. So what this professor was saying was not about transcendence or transmission. He was just talking about the way the mind works and from an anthropological point of view. But I think all of us can take something, take the realization that we have when we read something that's just mind-boggling or so uplifting or fills us with glee, that there's something besides the ink on the page or the sound of the words that's causing some other part of us to vibrate like a harp. And that's what Sri Aurobindo is a master of.
No, I agree that there is something to him in the way he writes, particularly in Savitri, like much more in Savitri than here, that it's hard to break up and define and attack and break into pieces and analyze. It's not analyzable, and I'm trying to analyze, because like that's what I'm doing right now in my work, right? We analyze everything. One of the things I'm trying to do is to compare male and female performance in STEM subjects, which is why I was talking to my professor. And like, that's the duality that I'm concerned with the most now. Like, and it seems like it's a very fundamental duality. Like we have Shakti and we have Ishvara. And that doesn't seem to go away. Like, it's always there, right? This duality is there. But maybe it is a yin-yang thing where somehow there is a unity that still allows a duality to express itself in. I mean, I don't see the point of it, though. I mean, in the supramental manifestation, didn't Mother say that there will be no sexual dimorphism? I think she has said that in the agenda, that there will be no man and woman, there will be only one unitary being.
She said that reproduction would not need sex, because
no,
it's going
to
it would be the manifestation of the psychic being.
Yeah.
So that there's no need, there's no biological need for sex in that situation. And that's what she's talking about. But she doesn't mean that sex is going to go away in the world.
She did say that. I think there will be no gender. The supramental being has no gender.
But I'm not talking about the supramental being. In that situation, she said those beings would be manifested by the psychic being manifesting.
Yeah.
But she wasn't talking about lions or
oh, right,
or
right. That of course. Yeah, no, I was just talking, I was just thinking about the duality of yin and yang, Shiva and Shakti, Purusha and Prakriti. Like, is that a fundamental duality that is somehow definitive of everything else, like. But then there is a transcendent, which so I believe that transcendent is above the Purusha and the Prakriti, right? Purusha and Prakriti both emanate from the transcendent. So the transcendent clearly has no duality in it.
You know, you could look at a poem, one of Aurobindo's sonnets called Shiva.
Oh, yeah, I know that one. I like it a lot.
Well, it's
I don't
about,
understand it. I don't understand anything. It's
about transcendence to emanation to evolution. It's got the whole thing in one sonnet.
No, I get
one,
what it's
one sonnet.
Yeah, he packs everything into just a few lines, particularly in Savitri. It's packed. It's so packed. You can't like break it down.
You can't ever break down Aurobindo. It's always bigger than the piece.
Nonetheless, analysis is legitimate.
Oh, yeah.
It's just not the whole thing. It's legitimate to do what you're doing.
Yeah, because I'm human, and human beings have to analyze, because otherwise
it's legitimate. Oh. But it's not the whole thing. It's not the whole picture, what you get from analyzing. That's the thing. It's not integral. It's a legitimate part, but it's not the whole thing.
But I think we have to have also at least some subconscious contact to these things. If we don't have subconsciously contact with these things, these are only words. Sri Aurobindo, by the way, describes how an intellectual, purely analytical mind would read Savitri. And he says it would be utter nonsense for him. Yeah, it's written in the letter on Savitri. And he says, if you read it from there, that level, you would see only contradictions and nonsense. And therefore, it is an invitation to, well, in Savitri, perhaps more psychic and spiritual. Here is more, I would say, the higher mind. An invitation to see things intuitively without trying to break them into millions of pieces. And yet, know the pieces. But then see the whole, connect the dots.
I think we're probably done for today. I don't know if I'm a set rate.
Yeah, done a lot of homework. We make 3 minutes meditation. Thank you very much to everyone.
See you next time.
Good luck with your studies, Radhika. I don't know if you have a session that's coming to an end here, but you have exams and stuff like that coming up, no?
Yeah, I have exams in, I think, 2 weeks. Yeah, it's hard. I feel so tired. It's Thanksgiving now, so I'm just just sleeping, that's all. I'm not doing anything.
Yeah, do it. Don't burn out. Even at the risk of losing everything, don't burn out.
Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
So good luck. Take care. Oh, bye-bye. Lost him.